Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, October 15th, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Foundation of Charity. Young philanthropists take pitches to promote giving in Decatur. Decatur has a reputation as a giving city. But not everyone has the ability or time to build houses, pack food, rescue animals, or help with other much-needed volunteer work. The Young Philanthropists was created for those who want to help, but find their limited time prevents them from doing so. It's also an opportunity to learn about nonprofits and where support is most needed in the community. We are not service-focused. We want to get people in the habit of giving early, co-chair Kelly Gagnon said of YP. Young Philanthropists' Giving Circle is under the umbrella of the Community Foundation of Macon County. The YP Steering Committee plans the events and activities for the group, meeting about three times a year, including a pitch party for organizations seeking a grant. It's a pretty low-commitment group, said Becky Stubblefield, co-chair of the steering committee. The name Young Philanthropists is meant to appeal to a younger crowd, but it doesn't set age limits. Members are simply young professionals in the community. They are also young at heart, Stubblefield said. There are no parameters for who joins. Annual dues are $125 for a single membership and $200 for couples. The funds are used as an endowment to provide the grant money. Activities are designed to introduce YP members to the community. Through the first event, the Community Foundation communicates with local nonprofit organizations, explaining their focus. We let them know we will be giving a grant and asking them for proposals and how they might use that money, Stubblefield said. During the summer, the members meet to review the grant proposals, but it's not just a meeting. One of the recent events, Beer and Philanthropy, was created to have a good time with the nonprofit organizations while learning about their proposals. And that brings some of the younger crowd, Gagnon said. The finalists are chosen for the pitch party. It is a Shark Tank-style event, said Stubblefield, referring to the popular ABC competition show. This year's pitch party will be at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, October 17th at the Children's Museum of Illinois. Tickets are $20 and available on the YP Facebook page. Guests can partake in food, drink, and voting. The YP events are also helpful for the nonprofit organizations. Instead of writing a huge, long grant, they are just making their pitch. And the ideas they have for $5,000, Gagnon said. Proposals are a simple two-page informational form. Members may ask the representatives questions for further information. Last year, the winner was Yoga for Cats, an organization offering foster services for cats, including neutering and adoption. Staff also hold yoga sessions with adoptable cats roaming free. They had a really fun, interacting presentation, Gagnon said. They had cat face signs and prop cats, and they were all meowing. It was almost like a skit, Stubblefield said. Yoga for Cats president Jeanette Scaluba applied for the grant to become a licensed foster-based rescue organization, as well as fund its program, We Educate, Trap, Neuter, Return, or otherwise known as WETNR. Scaluba said the grant money helped more than she had expected. We set out to do 70 cats in 2 years, she said about the neutering service. We did 85 in the first year. During the pitch party, Yoga for Cats used the props to get attention to build a crowd of fans and supporters, giving its proposal an enthusiasm edge. Having people believe in your cause is helpful, Scaluba said. Recruit your fans, Stubblefield said. After each organization gives a 3-minute presentation, the public and YP members attending the party will vote, allowing the winner to be named before the evening is over. The Decatur Parks Foundation applied last year for the grant to help fund a shade structure for Scoville Zoo, with top pitchman Ken Fry, the zoo's director, making the presentation. "He appeals to the crowd," said Jill Appleby, director for the Decatur Park Foundation. Macon Resources, Inc. also made a pitch, and although MRI was not chosen, Melanie Snively, a former MRI employee, said she enjoyed the event and learned about the other organizations. "It was a good experience," she said. "The pitches were so different, so it was difficult to compare." YP has had about 150 members since it began more than 5 years ago. Members from the community include Caterpillar employees, financial advisors, school employees, scientists, and nonprofit organizations. Gagnon and Stubblefield said the Community Foundation hopes to get young professionals into the habit of giving. "Beginning early sets the stage as they mature in their careers," Gagnon said, while Stubblefield noted it's also an opportunity to peek into the nonprofit world. "We like to get new people in the door, but we know they may just need a year to learn about giving and philanthropy," Stubblefield said. "That sets them up for success beyond that." The committee understands young professionals have time constraints, yet still want to give back to the community. "You can give a small amount and have a bigger impact," Stubblefield said. $125 may not have an impact on an organization, but the young philanthropists are going to turn that into $5,000, and that can make an impact. Gagnon said such experience is having a broader positive impact for YP members. They are branching out into the community in general. "Some have joined other boards," she said. "We have been a good transition." And this is part of the Together Decatur series, and if you know a person or story that exemplifies the best of Decatur, contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. A sidebar to this article also notes that if you go, it is the Young Philanthropists Pitch Party to be held 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, October 17th at the Children's Museum of Illinois. The cost is $20, and on the web, you can find them at www.facebook.com/YPGivingCircle. And next, continuing on the front page from the Illinois Bicentennial Series, Bloomington Mansion housed Lincoln Tactician. President appointed David Davis to the Supreme Court in 1862. Grand manors make up the skylines of many Illinois communities, but the history encapsulated at the David Davis Mansion in Bloomington holds it above the rest. Built in 1872 on Bloomington's then east side, the mansion was home to Judge David Davis and his wife, Sarah. Davis served as judge of the state's 8th Judicial Circuit Court, where he met and befriended an Illinois attorney by the name of Abraham Lincoln. "Davis and Lincoln rode the entire circuit together," said Jeff Salisbury, site manager for the mansion. "Davis had to ride the circuit because he was a judge, but Lincoln only did because he was driven to make something of himself." Salisbury said the duo spent plenty of time together, which led Davis acting as one of the biggest political operatives in Lincoln becoming president. "What Lincoln did for the circuit, and what the circuit did for him, is a large part of Illinois history. His time in central Illinois is what led him to becoming the 16th president of the U.S. and saving the Union," said Guy Fraker, retired Bloomington attorney and Lincoln scholar. At the Republican National Convention in Chicago in 1860, 5 candidates vied for the Republican nomination, including Lincoln, who was the least known candidate among the group. The judge, Davis, went to Chicago and secured hotel rooms for all the Illinois delegates and convinced them and others to vote for Lincoln, said Salisbury. Davis and his team used other tactics to boost Lincoln's name at the convention, and after the final vote was tallied, Lincoln was named Republican presidential nominee for the general election. Without Davis's advocacy, Fraker said Lincoln would not have been named president. A lot of factors got Lincoln nominated, but the biggest factor was he had a friend like Davis who was a very skilled politician in 1860. That's something we in Bloomington can be very proud of, said Fraker. Fraker also touched on a side of Davis and Lincoln's relationship that he said isn't particularly appealing. After Lincoln was elected president, there were two openings on the Supreme Court. All the lawyers who knew Davis told Lincoln to take care of him and give him a seat. Lincoln never responded to any of that, and their mutual friends were quite critical of his decision, said Fraker. After a long wait, Lincoln finally appointed Davis as Associate Justice on the Supreme Court in 1862. After Lincoln died, Davis said in a letter, "Lincoln was a peculiar man. He never asked my advice on any question. Sometimes I would talk to him and advise him. He would listen." Davis so strongly supported Lincoln because of his incredible integrity and intellectual honesty, said Fraker. The David Davis Mansion was built after Lincoln was assassinated, but prior to his presidency, Lincoln visited the Davises at their previous home, located on the same grounds in Bloomington. The barn on the grounds is original to that first house owned by the Davises, and the stable is exactly as it was 150 years ago. So Lincoln's horse was stabled here in the barn, said Salisbury. Other outbuildings still standing on the 4-acre lot, known as Clover Lawn, include a wood house, two privies, a foaling shed, a carriage barn, and an original flower garden. Davis commissioned French architect Alfred Picanard to complete the three-story yellow brick, 36-room mansion for $75,000. The elaborate Victorian style is a combination of Italianate and Second Empire architecture. Picanard also designed the Capitol building in Springfield. The mansion was well ahead of its time in terms of amenities, indoor plumbing, hot and cold running water, central heat, and gas lighting made up an impressive and modern estate. The last ancestors of the Davis family donated the house to the state in 1960, and it was opened as a state historic site. The research into the history of the building started before a single brush of paint was put on the walls for restoration, said Salisbury. The state initiated $2.58 million to use for restoration of the site, and years of research and labor resulted in a grand opening in 1992. Now, nearly 40,000 people tour the mansion each year. In 2007, it was deemed one of the 150 greatest places in Illinois by the American Institute of Architects. The site is also on the National Register of Historic Places and is a designated National Historic Landmark. We are thought of as a museum, but we're really an educational institution. You know the old adage, you're doomed to repeat mistakes if you don't learn from history. That holds true today, and it makes institutions like this more important than ever. We've got to know our past if we're going to succeed in the future, said Salisbury. The mansion grounds at 1000 East Monroe Drive in Bloomington are open for public tours from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Wednesday through Saturday. Admission is free, but donations are accepted. Visitors watch a brief video on the history of the mansion at the Visitor Center before joining a 50-minute tour of the home, which delves into the lives of David and Sarah Davis, Lincoln, and the Irish Catholic servants who worked in the mansion. After a tour through two levels of the mansion, visitors can check out the gift shop and the 19th century flower garden. For information about special events and regular tours, visit www.daviddavismansion.org. Next, Ryan Voiles writes from Decatur, panel rejects harassment complaint. Worker was employed in jail. A former Macon County Sheriff's Office employee alleges she was sexually harassed in a complaint against the Sheriff's Office that's before a state panel. The woman, a former jail worker, in 2012 filed complaints against Macon County and Lieutenant Tony Brown, now the Democratic nominee for sheriff in the November election, saying he kissed and touched her against her wishes. The Illinois Human Rights Commission this summer dismissed the complaint against Brown. The woman did not appeal the decision in the 35-day window allowed under state law. An administrative law judge in 2016 recommended both complaints be dismissed, finding the woman not credible in her accusations of a hostile work environment. While it dismissed the complaint against Brown, the commission has not yet decided whether to dismiss the case against the sheriff's office. Brown, who has been with the sheriff's office since 1991, denies harassing the woman. He acknowledged saying a sexual comment made after a group training exercise that was later deemed inappropriate. In an interview last week, Brown said he was happy that the administrative law judge ruled in his favor. "It still makes my stomach drop to be accused of something like that," he said. The woman declined a request to be interviewed on the record for this story. The Herald and Review typically does not name accusers of alleged or proven sexual misconduct without their permission. Her Springfield attorney, Bradley Wilson, did not respond to requests for comment. The Herald and Review learned of the allegations after being contacted by an anonymous source and another person on social media who both provided a copy of the woman's initial complaint. The newspaper filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the state to obtain a full record, which was received October 3rd. The record spans hundreds of pages and includes a transcript of the two-day hearing held on the matter in 2014. Brown is facing Republican Jim Root, also a top lieutenant with the sheriff's office, in the coming election. Root denies having anything to do with the information provided to the Herald and Review. "Somebody's got something out for him, but it's not me," said Root, who was hired by the sheriff's office in 1996. "I'm not planning on retiring. I have to be able to work with him even if I don't win, so I don't want to damage that relationship." When asked if he thought the attacks were coming from his political opposition, Brown said yes, but he stressed that he wanted to spend the final weeks of the campaign focused on a positive message. "I don't get into all the negativity and all that stuff," he said. "The only thing I can do is focus on positive things and the positive change that I believe I can help facilitate within this community. So that's my driving force." Brown pointed to the timing of the woman's complaint being filed, 6 days after she resigned as a correctional officer. At the time, she was suspended with pay, the result of an investigation into alleged drug possession by her boyfriend. Authorities said she gave inconsistent answers. The complaints were filed with the Illinois Department of Human Rights, which later that year forwarded them to the commission. The commission conducts public hearings on complaints of discrimination, and a judge can order employers to pay for lost pay, benefits, and other fees if wrongdoing is found. Punitive damages are not covered. Commission members were set to discuss the complaint against the sheriff's office at an August meeting, for which records were not immediately available. Christine M. Welninski, an employee with the commission, said in an email last week that the case against the sheriff's office is pending. William Koenig, a Rosemont attorney representing the county, said his office would have been notified if the commission had made a decision in August. They looked at it. It's on their calendar, and we should be getting an order any time now, he said. Commission officials directed other questions from the Herald and Review to spokeswoman Nicole Wilson, who then forwarded them to Illinois Department of Human Rights spokesperson Tegan Schull. Multiple emails and phone messages were not returned. Koenig said he expected the commission to follow the administrative law judge's decision and decide in favor of the sheriff's office. The allegations contained in the two charges are identical, he said. There's nothing any different, he said. It would be legally inconsistent for them to have a ruling other than accepting the report and recommendation of the judge that the charge be dismissed. Jay Dunn, chairman of the Macon County Board and current Sheriff Howard Buffett, declined to comment on the pending matter. Thomas Schneider, who was sheriff at the time and was among those who testified at the hearing, said the office was named in a separate case solely based on the fact that the office is the employer of Lieutenant Brown. Unfortunately, the case is still pending due to backlog at the commission, and no official ruling has been made regarding the Macon County Sheriff's Office. Harassment allegations. In legal filings and testimony during 2014 hearing in Springfield, the woman alleged a pattern of physical and verbal sexual harassment from Brown, her supervisor at the Macon County Jail. She said the incidents began in March 2011 when she had been working at the sheriff's office for about 5 years. On several occasions, she said, Brown went into a control room where she was working alone, rubbed her shoulders, and kissed her neck. In two instances in his office, she said, he placed her hand on his crotch once after he had unzipped his pants. She said he also kissed her against her will multiple times. The woman said Brown apologized after the incidents, saying he wanted to be sheriff someday and knew the behavior looked bad. Several witnesses who testified on the woman's behalf said she had told them about unwanted advances, but none saw the harassment occur firsthand. The woman also testified about an incident at a training exercise in 2010 when she and 9 other officers had a stun gun used on them. Brown recorded the exercise on his cell phone and told the woman later that the noise she made when the device was used on her sounded like an orgasm, according to the documents. In testimony and filings with the commission, Brown acknowledged making the comment. The woman said Brown also asked her if that was how she sounded in bed, which he denied. Upon learning of the comment, then-Sheriff Schneider verbally reprimanded Brown for inappropriate language, and no further action was taken, according to the documents. Administrative Law Judge Michael Robinson presided over the hearing, after which both sides filed additional legal documents in the proceeding. He ultimately recommended it be dismissed with prejudice, a legal term meaning the case cannot be refiled. Robinson wrote in his 22-page report that, for various reasons, he did not find parts of the woman's testimony credible. Specifically, he noted the woman said Brown had sent her several Facebook messages apologizing for his behavior. Another witness also said she saw a message matching that description, but no copies of the messages were presented as evidence. Robinson also noted the timing of the woman's discrimination complaint. The Decatur Police Department conducted an investigation into her boyfriend in April 2012 that included a controlled purchase of drugs with marked currency. Some of the money was later found in a safe, to which the woman initially said only she had access, according to the documents. The woman was suspended with pay after she was questioned by sheriff's office investigators, who said they found inconsistencies in her story. 7 days later, she resigned. In response to Robinson's findings, the woman's attorney wrote that the judge had overlooked or failed to consider evidence that reflected on Brown's credibility, as well as the woman's. Specifically, Wilson wrote that the judge did not give sufficient weight to the testimony of several witnesses and failed to take into account inconsistencies in Brown's testimony. In the documents, Wilson argued that the woman told several people about the unwanted advances from Brown before April 2012, when the police investigation began. It is unclear why the complaint against the sheriff's office is still not resolved after 2 years following the administrative law judge made his recommendation. But Republican Governor Bruce Rauner said earlier this year that the state commission had more than 1,000 pending cases. Some had gone 2 years or longer without a decision, he said. Rauner signed an executive order in June designed to cut down on the backlog by mandating coordination between the commission, the State Department of Human Rights, and the Bureau of Administrative Hearings. A new state law also went into effect this August that would restructure how the commission works, including turning some part-time staff to full-time to help streamline caseloads. And moving to the local briefs from Decatur, Growing Strong Volunteer Training. Growing Strong Sexual Assault Center will hold a 40-hour training course for those interested in volunteering in their Decatur office. Training is scheduled for 5:30 to 9:30 p.m., Tuesday and Thursday evenings, November 6th through December 6th, at 270 West Prairie Avenue. Volunteers are needed to take hotline calls, raise funds, provide prevention education, and perform office duties. Growing Strong assists those affected by sexual assault with 24-hour crisis counseling, ongoing mental health support, medical and legal advocacy, and awareness and prevention education in the community and for law enforcement. The office is part of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, ICASA, a statewide network of nonprofit crisis centers. Growing Strong serves Macon, Piatt, Shelby, Moultrie, and DeWitt counties. For more information, contact Emily at 217-428-0770 or visit their website, growingstrongcenter.org. Next, November 1st deadline on seniors' tax freeze. The annual renewal deadline for the Senior Citizen Property Tax Assessment Freeze exemption is Tuesday, November 1st. Property owners should bring their 2017 federal tax return and 1099 forms to the Macon County Assessor's Office in the Macon County Office Building, 141 South Main Street, for assistance in completing the form. Property owners who have never filed and are 65 or older with a household income of less than $65,000 may qualify for this exemption. For more information, call 217-424-1364. And next, delinquent property taxes due November 16th. All delinquent real estate property taxes from the 2017 tax year must be received by the Macon County Treasurer's Office no later than the end of the day Friday, November 16th, according to Treasurer Ed Yoder. These taxes must be paid with cash, certified bank check, or credit card in the Treasurer's Office. Online real estate property tax payments are not accepted. Any unpaid property taxes will go to tax sale on Monday, November 19th. For more information, call the Treasurer's Office at 217-424-1426. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for October 15th, 2018. Please stay tuned.